The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay. Hi. The topic we're going to do today is Golden Age of Spain under Islam, Reconquest, Spanish Inquisition, which nobody expects, those of us who know Monty Python, right? And one of my favorite topics of trivia, which is Christopher Columbus's Jewish connection. Just before we go into that, one last word about the Islamic view of Judaism. The official view, not the personal view of Muslims towards Jews. But if you look in the Quran itself, it's very interesting. The Quran has, I would say, a relatively positive view of Judaism and a very negative view of Jews. Just to give you a couple of examples, this is from I can't read my Roman numerals here, but a quote from the Quran. It says, "Verily, they who believe and they who follow the Jewish religion shall have their reward in the Lord." So that's like a nice thing about Judaism in general. But then it says, this is chapter 50, surah number 4. I got to check what that is, because usually chapters and surahs are the same thing. "Vendors are they, the Jews of error, and are desirous that you go astray from the way. But God has cursed them for their unbelief. Few only of them are believers." So that's like a general view of Jews is quite negative. Christianity, it's interesting, by the way, flip side. Very negative things said about Christianity, especially the idea of Trinity. You know, again, it's like one of the beliefs that the Muslims found completely unacceptable, but rather a pretty positive view of Christians. So, and again, in practice, as I said yesterday, how Jews are treated will vary tremendously from place to place. As we look now in the history of Jews in Spain, I think we'll get a much better appreciation of that. Okay, so I mentioned, you know, the Islam expands very rapidly, not just to the Middle East, but also to North Africa. It sort of stopped around Constantinople, so it doesn't expand into Eastern Europe, so to speak. It does go into the Far East, however. But it does cross in 711 the Moors. Okay, it's a date no Americans will forget, 711. The Moors was just sort of a generic term to refer to, like kind of like Saracens or whatever term that Westerners used to refer to Arabs of that period of time. Cross over the Straits of Gibraltar and invade Spain. Spain, since about the 6th century, 5th century, was occupied by a number of people. Spain has been occupied for all kinds of people, Carthaginians and Romans and you name it. But beginning in the late 5th, especially in the 6th century, the Visigoths, who are Germanic peoples who migrated from the steppes of Russia through Europe and are going to end up settling in Spain and converting to Christianity, are going to settle in Spain. So it's a Christian country. The Moors, who are basically Berbers, nomadic North African people converted to Islam, who were part of this rapid Islamic expansion, are going to cross the Straits of Gibraltar, invade, and conquer all of Spain. As a number of different peoples who are going to be living, Arab peoples, if you read the history of Spain from the 8th century through the 13th century, you'll come across a number of different terms. One is Moors, which is sort of a general term. The other are the Almoravids, sort of sound like Moors, who come later, also a nomadic North African people who settled there, followed by the Almohades. So I'll talk about all these people who go through their chronology. Also a nomadic Berber people from North Africa, very fanatically religious, very anti-Christian, especially anti-Jewish. Okay, so and finally we're going to have the Christians coming back in again. So you get, there's a lot of different peoples living in Spain. So just not to go through all the details of who's living when, which dynasties, plus there's going to be an Umayyad, one of the Umayyad leaders from the Middle East is going to move to Spain also and set up a sort of Umayyad dynasty at the same time. So there's a lot of different Muslim peoples in Spain, and it's going to cover a period of time. We're talking about over 700 years from the time when the Muslims first come, the Arabs, to the time when they're completely expelled during Ferdinand and Isabella, which is 1492, which corresponds to Christopher Columbus and the expulsion. And again, the treatment of Jews under these people is going to vary, and I'll give you some practical examples as we go along. Okay, so Jews, yeah.
Real quickly, you had mentioned Charles.
Yeah, the Battle of Tours in 732 is the Moors. These are the people when the Muslims cross into Spain, they conquer all of Spain and they expand. You know, they go over the Pyrenees, the mountains that separate Spain from France, and try and cross into France itself, and they're stopped by Charles Martel. Okay, we're talking about we're not talking about really large Christian empires at the time. He is the most powerful, probably, lay leader in Europe. Right.
And they don't go any further.
Stopped outside of Paris. Not only don't go further there, but they're pushed back over the Pyrenees. If they had stayed there, you could be speaking Spanish instead of French today. Who knows? You would be speaking Arabic. I don't know. You might be Muslim. If they had gotten through, obviously, all of the history of Europe could well have been very different. Because they do try after. We'll see. Go jump way ahead in history to the Ottoman Turkish time. They will get up in the 16th century. They will get to Vienna, Austria, and be stopped there also. There's a number of battles. They're stopped by a Venetian fleet also at the same time. The Ottomans in a big battle, Lipendano, I think it's called. Yeah, but from the 8th century up until the Ottomans make another push on Europe much later in history, we're talking about 800 years later, there's not going to be any major... So we're at a standstill. For several hundred years, Arabs are going to control Spain, and then we're going to see already going back several hundred, like the 13th century primarily, till the 15th century, the Spanish are going to begin the reconquest. So, but during this period of time, Jews, who always will migrate with expanding empires, just as in Rome, Jews migrate as Rome expands, Jews will move into Spain. Remember, we're talking about already by this period of time, Jews have moved through North Africa. They've started to leave the Middle East. They moved through North Africa. This is the origins of all of the North African Jewish communities, which until the Russian Aliyah, were the majority of immigrants to Israel, especially Moroccans, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and these old communities were established going back to that period of time. They cross the Straits of Gibraltar with the Moors, and they'll settle in Spain. And, of course, Jews, as in everywhere we see in medieval Europe, are very useful people to have around because they're very good. They're literate in general. They have great trade connections. They're going to be used by the different Muslim courts as state officials, tax collectors, chancellors of the exchequer, whatever you call them, the English term, you know, treasurers, you name it, they're used for it. Okay, not only that, because there are Jews living in Visigoth Spain or whatever, and in France, and also Jews living, basically Jews employed by Christians and Jews employed by Muslims, they're going to be the great middlemen for diplomacy also. Okay, so we have Jews will move into Spain, and the early Islamic rulers, the Moors, the Almoravids, are very, very tolerant of the Jews. Again, not that Jews had total equality, they didn't. But this is one of the best examples of Muslims being nice to Jews. And because Muslims are nice to Jews, Jews will rise to positions of tremendous prominence. I'm going to go through a whole list of people very quickly who you, if you study medieval Spanish Muslim Jewry, these names will all come up. So you have a number of Jews who rise to positions of incredible prominence, Jews contributing very significantly culturally and economically, and in many ways to Spanish Islamic culture. So both sides, a nice symbiotic relationship. We see a classic pattern in history. Jews are tolerated and allowed free reign. The Gentile majority benefits and the Jews benefit and the whole society is elevated. And of course, it's all going to come crashing down with the expulsion. Just to go through a bunch of different people. First of all, Chasdai ibn Shaprut. Couple of names you can look all guys up in detail. He lives from about 915 till 990. He's the earliest person we're going to look at. He is an advisor to Abdul al-Rahman, who's the caliph of Cordoba. The capital of Muslim Spain is going to be first Seville, very early in the 8th century, and immediately it's going to become Cordoba. And Cordoba, where Maimonides is also from, we'll see later, is going to be really the center of Islamic Spanish culture. And there's going to be a lot of Jews there and a lot of Jewish accomplishment focused on that city. He was a very... Not only does he rise to a position of tremendous prominence in not just the Jewish community as a government official of the Muslim caliph, but he also is going to be very important in strengthening the Jewish community in Spain. Another person who is very important is Shmuel HaNagid. You guys heard of Shmuel HaNagid, who lives from 993 to 1055. He was also born in Cordoba. He moves to Granada, which is the last city that's going to fall, by the way, when the Spanish reconquer Spain. You ever seen the movie El Cid with Charlton Heston? They got that scene outside Granada. He is, besides being a great Jewish scholar, is going to be the vizier of the caliph. Okay, tremendously powerful. He's the commander of the armies, like the Arnold Schwarzkopf of the Moors, which is a pretty impressive position for a Jew to rise in at that period of time. Shlomo ibn Gabriel, 1020 to 1058. Another great scholar, poet, by the way, what's very interesting is going to be in Moorish Spain, is going to be the golden age, not just of Spanish Jewish Jews in Islamic culture, but it's really the golden age in many respects of Islamic culture, period. You have tremendous creativity in the sciences, especially in literature, a lot of beautiful poetry. And you're going to have a lot of Jews, we're talking about even rabbis who are great poets, who write beautiful things in not just in Hebrew, but even in Arabic. And by the way, Jews in Spain would often write in Hebrew using Arab characters.
very interesting. But Yiddish, I want to talk a little about languages in a few minutes. But Yiddish is sort of like German Hebrew mixed together, but written in Hebrew, so the Jews would actually write often using Arabic letters, but actually be writing in Hebrew. Or even vice versa, so you could use, it's like kind of transliterating. So you have Shlomo Ibn Gabriel, great Torah scholar, great poet. Even more significant, someone I know you've all heard of, Yehuda Halevi, 12th century, 1085 to 1141, who's one of the great poet scholars of this period of time in Spain. A person who seems to have been a bit disillusioned by the decadence of not just of Jewry. It's kind of like Borough Park, you know, it's too comfortable. So he decides to go to Israel. Unfortunately, he's trampled by a horse and dies almost immediately upon his arrival. But he is the author of the Kuzari, which is the book I mentioned previously. Also a tremendous poet. The Kuzari is that supposed dialogue that takes place between the king of the King Bulan of the Khazars and a rabbi when he's deciding. Remember the Khazar kingdom? The Khazars living near the Black Sea, who decide to convert to Judaism. So he's the author of that book. You can buy the Kuzari today. It's still the best exposition of what we call the historical period. Okay, if you want more information on that, ask me after, I'll explain, but it's an very interesting book. There's Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, 1090 to 1164, the Ibn Ezra, who's a great commentator on the Torah. You can still get a commentary today. Yitzhak Alfazi, the Rif, another name you'll come across if you get into more detailed study of Jewish texts, especially legal texts. Rabbi Meir Halevi Abu Lafia, HaRama, Rabbi Yonah HaChassid of Girona, Rabbeinu Bechaya Ben Asher, Ish HaLevi, who's the author of the Sefer HaChinuch. Okay, supposedly there's a lot of scholarship going on in like the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries in Spain. Now, again, I could say much more about this. We don't have time to go into the lives of all of these people. I do want to talk about a few who are very, very significant, namely, especially Maimonides, in just a couple of minutes. But just to appreciate, this is a period of time when Jews are tolerated and they rise to tremendous prominence and are very creative. And we have a lot of the stuff we learn today, Torah sources from the Sephardic world, goes from this period of time. Unfortunately, in the mid-12th century, the Almohades, who I mentioned previously, also Berbers from North Africa, are going to invade and conquer most of Spain from the Almoravids. They're very fanatically religious people. And remember I said previously, Jews never do well amongst Gentiles who are really from. These are people who actually forcibly convert Jews. They actually murder Jews. We have several huge pogroms in Spain. There's, I think, like something like 5,000 Jews murdered in 1066, which is the same date, for those of you who know your English history, as the Battle of Hastings. You have a huge anti-Jewish pogrom sponsored by our good friends, the Almohades. So already we see the Golden Age has already peaked out and is waning. The Almohades' control of Spain is going to... Their dynasty falls in the early 13th century. So as their dynasty wanes, it creates a power vacuum, and this is when the Spanish Christians are going to really begin the reconquest, which is going to take several hundred years. Just to take a break from the history, and I want to talk a couple minutes about Maimonides. Maimonides, who I'm sure all of us are familiar with... By the way, you guys want to work on your Hebrew skills. The way I learned my Hebrew for learning was by going through the Rambam, okay, in Hebrew. He's a great work to go through, the Mishneh Torah I want to talk about in a minute. But he is one of the most significant personalities in medieval Jewish history. His dates are 1135 to 1204. So we think of Maimonides, we think basically of the 12th century. Maimonides is born in Cordoba. And in 1135, remember Cordoba being the center of Islamic Spanish culture, it's conquered in 1150, it's conquered by the Almohades, the fanatical guys, which makes life very difficult for many of the Jews who choose to look for, not necessarily greener pastures, but to move to different places. In the case of Maimonides, he with his family, meaning his extended family, is going to move to Israel. Okay, if you go to Cordoba today, and really all of Spain, and who's been to Spain? All of Spain is probably one of the largest, you know, I think Eastern Europe is like a Jewish cemetery. All of Spain is a tremendous Jewish cemetery. There's so many Jews living in Spain. Really, a tremendous percentage of the Jewish population of the Sephardi world have moved to Spain. Hundreds of thousands of Jews living there. As a matter of fact, when they had the Olympic in Barcelona, in what year was that? In 1990? 92? the stadium was built on the Jewish cemetery of Barcelona. The whole Jewish community of Barcelona was slaughtered, by the way, in a pogrom. But when the Christians reconquer it. But you see, everywhere you go, there were Jews in Spain, all the major communities, to the point where I've heard historians say that virtually anyone in Spain today has Jewish blood. So many Jews were there, and so many Jews assimilated, and we get to the expulsion and how many tens of thousands of Jews would convert to Christianity, etc. So believe me, this is one of the most significant places historically. If you go to Cordoba today, there's a statue of Maimonides. Okay, right there. And then some of the mosques and churches that are converted from synagogues. It's a very famous mosque there, and also it's originally a synagogue. I think it's actually a church now, I'm not sure. If you go to the Diaspora Museum, they have a model of it. You guys been to the Diaspora Museum? They have all these models of very significant synagogues in Europe and in the Middle East. You can see, I think, a model of that. Maimonides moves to Israel, and Israel at the time is not a very easy place to live in, so he goes to Egypt, which is, by the way, it's illegal for Jews to live there. He used to sign all of his letters. You know, Moses ben Maimonides, who violates X number of commandments in the Torah daily by living in Egypt. That's how he signed his letters. He really wasn't doing the right thing. He was initially basically a scholar who was supported by his brother David, who was a businessman. David, unfortunately, goes off to the Far East, as many Jews were, on a business trip. Business trips in the Middle Ages took years. You did probably three or four of them in your lifetime, but you made enough money on them that you could retire afterwards. And he's killed. David is killed. Maimonides is forced to support himself. He becomes a physician, which is the great medieval Jewish trade. Jews as doctors. Not that medicine was a very exact science. I don't think medicine became even very serious until pretty much this century. Okay, but Maimonides is certainly one of the greatest physicians of the medieval period. I mentioned previously, who was he a physician to? Salah al-Din, right? Who is the Kurd who ruled out of Egypt, who is the leader of the Islamic army that defeats the in 1187 the Crusader army at Hattin, near the Sea of Galilee. So Salah al-Din has a Jewish doctor, which is probably why he's so positive towards the Jews. But Maimonides is very well known for his medical writings, court physician. I don't think he was actually much of Salah al-Din's personal doctor, but he was the family physician. I'm sure he was on call at all hours of the day and night. And it's a great tribute. Again, we see a classic case of Jews being tremendously successful in their secular professions as well as being great Torah scholars. Maimonides, in the middle of trying to support his family and be a doctor, also manages to put together some of the greatest works of Jewish literature. Most important thing that he does, well, first of all, he does in 1180, he completes a complete, very organized codification of all of the oral law called the Yad Chazakah. Yad means hand, but it also means 14. Yud Dalid, a 14-volume work in which he codifies all of the oral law. People familiar with this? We call it the Mishneh Torah. Okay? And it is today, in hindsight, we appreciate it's one of the greatest works of Jewish scholarship ever put together. Another even more controversial work he put together was called the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, 10 years later, and in 1190. Which is a book which was very controversial because he says things in it which are very hard to understand. It's very metaphysical. He brings in all kinds of very interesting ideas. Also, his statements, one of the big, so to speak, problems with the Yad, the Mishneh Torah, as brilliant as it is, he doesn't really give sources. If you know your Talmud Baal Peh, which very few of us are lucky enough to know, you'll notice where he pulls everything out of. But otherwise, he's just pulling out sources and assuming you know where they're coming from. He also makes a statement that now that we have my Yad Chazakah, you don't really need to learn Talmud because it's all there right for you. You can just learn this instead, which is a pretty heavy statement to make. In his lifetime and after his lifetime, as brilliant as his work was, in the 13th century especially, many Jewish scholars of primarily, we're talking about southern France, which is the center of Jewish community, as I mentioned previously, one of the centers of Jewish community, came out very strongly against Maimonides' works. It was too radical. Some of the things he said were not understood. They were too controversial. People maybe misinterpreted his intentions. As a matter of fact, some of the rabbis instigated against, especially the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, and these books were burned in Paris in the 13th century. This is our good friend Louis the Ninth, St. Louis. They had burned. Okay, excuse me. That's a little bit later. I'm getting ahead of myself. The Yad is burned in 1233. Okay, and his books at the instigation of Jewish rabbis. And 9 years later, in 1242, Louis the Ninth, St. Louis, burns the Talmud in Paris. And many rabbis said after, especially people like Rabbeinu Yonah of Girona, who's author of the book Shari Tshuva. Anyone seen this book? Very important book we read about Tshuva. Rabbeinu Yonah, many scholars speculate that he wrote Shari Tshuva as a form of penitence for his bad-mouthing the works of Maimonides. And it was also said at the time that the reason why the Talmud was burned was because Jews instigated against Maimonides, and his books were burned. So it's a very interesting. Well, it's a dangerous precedent for book burning in the Jewish world. And it says something about that the fact the Jewish world was becoming progressively more reactionary and things that are new and controversial. Certainly later on in Jewish history don't go over so well. It often takes a lot of time to appreciate how great they are. But we see that it's going to lead to what is a very bad reaction. And again, we say many scholars speculate that the Shari Tshuva was actually, the book was written as a form of penitence for his instigation against works of Maimonides. But in hindsight, we now living centuries later appreciate that this is one of the great works of genius. It certainly shows that Maimonides had all of the oral Torah at his fingertips and organizes in a way that is far more systematic and easy to learn than it is to plow through the Talmud. And you guys who stay here long enough, you'll certainly appreciate. If you want to get a great overview of Kol HaTorah Kulo, of the whole Jewish worldview, not just legally, but philosophically, you read Maimonides. Fantastic thing to read. Another very significant person. Someone had a question, by the way, you wanted to ask? Good question, Jeff? Nachmanides. Okay, not to confuse. Moses, sorry? Oh, Shari Tshuva. Oh, okay. It's a good book to read. It's heavy, very heavy stuff. Nachmanides, who's later, 1195 to 1270, whose name is Moshe ben Nachman. You guys clear we're getting the name from? Maimonides, Nachmanides, they're acronyms. You take the first letter. Again, Jews don't have last names at the time. So it's so-and-so, son of so-and-so. So Moshe ben Maimon, or Moshe ben Nachman. So you just take the first letter and you get Ramban, Rambam. It's the synagogue in the Jewish quarter is the Nachmanides, the Ramban, not the Rambam. We just do this to confuse you. Remember Yerevan, Rachavam. He is born in Bar. His year is 1195 to 1270. He lives to be a ripe old age by that time. 75 years old that period of time. He is born in Barcelona, which is already under Christian control. Tremendous Jewish scholar. Tremendous Jewish scholar. He wrote an incredible commentary on the Bible, which I highly recommend. It is very metaphysical and Kabbalistic, especially his stuff on the early chapters of Genesis. Fascinating stuff. If you're into like a little bit of Kabbalistic understanding of what's going on in the Bible, he's the man to read. I want to mention him specifically because he's involved in what is certainly the most famous of the disputations. We're going to see in medieval Europe what are called debates between Jews and Christians. The idea is that Christians are attempting to prove to Jews that they're wrong to get them to convert. Now, disputations were things that Jews would try and avoid like the plague. First of all, it was a no-win situation. It was always a lose-lose situation. A, because in general, Jews were not allowed to in any way denigrate Christianity in the debate. It's like Rabbi Berger, Monty Berger, our resident expert on Christianity, per se. It's like, you're allowed to come in, but you can't say anything bad about Christianity or Jesus or in any way denigrate our reading of the text. So it's like trying to debate when you have no access to sources. Okay, and so it was always a lose-lose situation because the Jews would lose the debate, or if they would win the debate, in any case, it would mean bad news for the Jewish community. What happens in 1263 is a Jewish convert to Christianity, and these are always the worst guys to watch out for in history. No one is a bigger anti-Semite than a Jew who's trying to out-Gentile the Gentiles or out-Christian the Christians. His name is Pablo Christiani. How's that for taking a Christian name, you know? Pablo challenges Nachmanides to debate, which would be the equivalent of, like, forget me, I'm probably compared to Pablo, a big Talmud Chacham, but the equivalent to, like, your average completely ignorant Jew challenging Rev Shach or something to a debate on, you know, Jewish law. You're talking about totally missed, you know, like your high school physics teacher challenging Einstein. You know, we're talking about completely out of his league. Now, the uniqueness of this debate was that James I of Aragon, who was the king, allows Nachmanides, the Ramban, free reign to say whatever he likes, with a promise of immunity from repercussions and attack from the Christians. And you can read the disputation. It's a small book. BBC, it's amazing. BBC is so schizophrenic. Regarding Israel, they're horrible. Regarding Judaism, they're unbelievably good. They did a 100% accurate
adaptation called the disputation. We have somewhere floating on Ancient Torah, the video. I'm amazed that any Christian country would produce such a thing because it completely wipes the floor with Christianity. I mean, he makes a dish rag out of Pablo Cristiani. At the end of this debate, James I says, and I quote, "I have never seen a man support a wrong cause so well." And he gives him 300 pieces of gold and promises him immunity. Of course, the immunity doesn't work. Nachmanides is being threatened by the church, who is absolutely furious. He has to flee for his life. And in 1267, he comes to Israel. And he comes to Jerusalem. We're talking about when Israel's a very small Jewish community in the whole land of Israel. And in Jerusalem, there's almost no Jews living here at the time. Matter of fact, there's so few Jews living here. When he comes, he can't get 10 men together to make a minyan to pray. He has to go to Hebron and import a couple Jews. He sets up a synagogue outside on Mount Zion. Okay? And later on, after his death, in around the year 1400, that synagogue will be moved inside the walls of Jerusalem. And because of Islamic dini laws, right, they will build a subterranean synagogue, which is today the Ramban synagogue. So the Ramban himself never prayed there. It's after his lifetime, by more than 100 years. But it's connected with him because it's like that's where they moved the shul to, and they kept the name. Later, of course, it's going to be turned into like a warehouse, and the Muslims are going to desecrate it and turn it into like a cheese factory and a storage ground. After 67, it's just going to be filled with rubble and re-excavated and rededicated. And if you go in there today, it's very interesting. Underneath the arch I'm talking about, it's the subterranean synagogue. They have a big letter in plexiglass of Nachmanides' letter to his son. Okay, Shema Avicha Val Kitosh Musa. It's a very interesting letter. You can read it, read the translation. Yeah. Disputation. Yeah, it's very interesting to read. But if anyone's interested in refutation of Christianity from a purely philosophical, theological perspective, it's the classic work to read. But it just goes to show you, it says a lot about the situation of the Jews in general. And this is one of the unique disputations in history. to go back to history, we talked about some of the big personalities. To go back to a little of the history now. Starting in 1085, already the late 11th century, we're going to have the beginnings of the reconquest, beginning with the fall of the city of Toledo. Basically, the Spanish, and Spain is not one group. There are different provinces in Spain. There's Aragon, there's Castile, there's different nobility associated with those provinces who will, when we get to Ferdinand and Isabella, and we have the unification of what is the territory of Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon, then you'll have a very strong, united, for the first time in a very long time, Spanish monarchy and a unified Spain. But until that time, it's a piecemeal conquest led by different nobility. It's Christians against Muslims. Again, a sort of continuation of the Holy War. And if you look at what I'm talking about, 1085, and we're talking about when was the crusade of the Christians going to Europe? 1095 it begins. It was very much the Crusades of Europe. Everything is interrelated here. We're very much fueled because what's going on in Spain is related to Western Europe, not so much the Middle East. Okay, but it's very much the sentiment was largely fueled of the Roman Catholic Church was largely fueled. The anti-Muslim sentiment was to a great extent influenced by what was going on with the Muslim conquest of Spain and the fighting going on there. So it's sort of an extension of the same conflict. So we have two big hot points of Christian-Muslim conflict. One is in the Middle East, we're going to see, in the Eastern Christian Empire, and the other is going to be all the way in the West. But it's the Muslims coming around both ways. So we have a period of conquest going from the 11th to the late 15th century, which goes in fits and starts. The end of the conquest is the fall of Granada in 1492. Okay, again, go see the movie El Cid. That's the last Muslim stronghold on the Iberian Peninsula. When that falls, that's it for the Muslims in Spain. They are long since gone. Their influence can very clearly be seen in the art and architecture of the period. They left their mark, but they're gone. And Spain returns to being a Christian country. As soon as that happens, we're going to see a very different situation, or as it's happening, in terms of the Jews. When the Spanish Christians are reconquering Spain, they need the Jews. This is a classic case of can't live with them, can't live without them. Okay, it's interesting. The Jews are sort of trying to play both sides of the game here. Okay? And, for instance, during the Almoravids, who were very brutally anti-Semitic, and we have all sorts of forced conversions and slaughters of Jews, many of the Jews will switch sides and go over to the Spanish Christians, who were at that time nicer. Okay? As the Spanish are reconquering reconquering Spain, you will have instances of slaughter of Jewish communities. I'm going to read you. I think I have even... I don't have a letter in here from it. I have a letter. I didn't bring it with me. It's very interesting, talking about the slaughter of the Jewish community of Barcelona. But you will have anti-Jewish riots for sure, sponsored by Christians. It's sort of like a way of celebrating. We see medieval Europe, right? Let's have a party and kill Jews. But Jews will also be used by the Spanish to reorganize Spanish Christian control over Spain. And again, there'll be several Jews in very high positions of prominence who will be used by the Christian government as tax collectors and as translators and as diplomats and you name it. But there's going to be all kinds of forced conversions and lots of bad things going on. What I want to focus on now is basically the Inquisition, okay, which is something which people are familiar with, the Spanish Inquisition. The first Inquisition is going to start in Aragon in 1233. The big Inquisition, however, is going to take place starting in 1478. Okay, the Inquisition we know about. What were the Inquisitions based on? As Jews were reabsorbed into Christian reconquest of Spain, there was often pressure put on them to convert. Okay, Jews, one thing you won't find, today you'll find Jews for Jesus, unfortunately, Jews who are really into Christianity. You will very rarely find Jews. It's a very small number of Jews, although many Jews may have converted at periods of time in Jewish history, usually almost always forced, meaning if you don't convert, I kill you, and many Jews would choose to be killed rather than convert, but some would give in and actually convert. They didn't do it because they like Christianity. They did it to save their skins. We'll see later, hundreds of years later in Europe, in the 19th century, many Jews will convert, not because they're into Christianity, but because, in the words of people like Heinrich Heine, the great 19th century German writer, it's their ticket to European society. Okay, you want to be fully accepted in Western European society, you converted. So there were certainly large numbers of Jews who gave their lives rather than convert, but also a large number of Jews who actually chose to be forcibly converted. Once Jews converted to Christianity, they had open access to the playing field economically and politically. And that's going to engender a lot of hostility from the old Christians. New Jewish converts were called either new Christians, that's a nice phrase, or derogatorily they were called moranos, which is the Spanish word for swine or pig, or conversos, those who converted. And they would often be attacked out of just outright jealousy. The basic accusation was these guys are not real converts to Christianity. They're secretly practicing Judaism. By the way, that was often the case. You had large numbers of Jews who would outwardly be Christian, but secretly practiced Judaism. Until this day, there are Christian communities. There's one community in Provincetown, which is a Portuguese community, okay, that goes all the way back to something like the 16th century, where they're Catholics, but on Friday night, many of the members of the community go down to their basement and light candles. They don't know why they do it, but they do it. There are even like people in like New Mexico and Arizona who are descended from original Spanish settlers in Mexico going back to that period of time who do the same thing. Where are these people obviously descended from? Secretly practicing Jews. Okay? And the Inquisition was a way of basically hounding them, finding them out. And the Inquisition was not a proper legal process. In 1478, let's talk about the Inquisition. And the Inquisitions are going to continue. They're going to be Inquisitions all the way up to the early 19th century. The last Jew burned at the stake is going to be, I think, in Brazil in the 19th century, because Jews will flee to there and the Inquisition will follow them. But in 1478, Ferdinand and Isabella, especially Isabella, right, who is the Queen of Castile, who marries Ferdinand, is going to ask Pope Cestus IV for permission to set up an Inquisition to weed out heresy in the Christian world. Now, Isabella is a very fanatical Christian. And she's really zealous. And this Inquisition, which is the famous Inquisition, which is going to lead ultimately to the expulsion, is going to be led by a man by the name of Thomas the Torquemada. People heard of Torquemada? Who, by the way, is descended from Jews. Another great example of a vicious, and he wasn't, I don't think he's luckily Jewish, but he had Jewish blood. And he was one of the biggest anti-Semites around. People, by the way, say that about Muammar Gaddafi. Every Libyan Jew I've met tells me he's actually halakhically Jewish. Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the leader of the extreme right in Russia. You know what they say his biography is? His biography is his mother is Russian and his father's a lawyer. I never knew lawyers was an ethnic group. Lawyer means that's like the secret code word meaning daddy's Jewish. Even though I'm a huge anti-Semite, you know. People like to speculate. Hitler, he wasn't. But it's interesting. It's a very common pattern. The Inquisition, again, very, very brutal. Jews are going to be, these conversos are going to be accused. You don't have any right to know who's, you can, by the way, if you speak Spanish, you can go to Hebrew University Library and read the records of all these different Inquisitions. Jews would be arrested, Okay, they wouldn't even know who was accusing them. Evidence would be presented to them in secret. They would often be tortured. That's, you know, medieval court systems were very based on due legal process, right? We torture you until you tell us the truth. Or we drop you in a river, and if you sink, you're obviously innocent. If you float, you're a witch or you drown. You know, you're obviously evil. You know, trial by combat. You guys fight, and obviously the one who wins is the one who's God helping, and therefore the right one. Interesting, medieval justice. It's come a long way. But you could be tortured till confession was extracted, and then if it was extracted, you had a choice. You could be burned at the stake. It's called an auto de fe, an act of faith. And at the last minute, if you chose to kiss the cross, they would strangle you, and then you'd be saved the pain, the horrible pain of being burned alive. Between 1420 and 1498, 2,000 Jews are burned. Okay, new conversos are burned. Ultimately, it's going to end with the complete reconquest of Spain in 1492. Ferdinand and Isabella, once Spain has been reconquered and the Muslims are thrown out, there's no need for the Jews anymore. They didn't like them anyway. We used you when we needed to use you, but now we don't need you, so we're going to throw you out. So in March of 1492, King Ferdinand signs an expulsion order, which is supposed to take place at the end of July, the very end of July. It's extended by 3 days till August 2nd, at which time the Jews are given basically less than 6 months to get rid of all their property and get out of Spain or to convert. Okay, and this is, can you imagine? Imagine like suddenly President Clinton, you know, big friend of the Jews supposedly, issues an order that the Jewish community of America, which has been there for hundreds of years, the most successful, prosperous Jewish community, has 6 months to sell all their property in Brooklyn and everywhere else and leave the country. We're talking about complete devastation. First of all, we're talking about a fire sale on Jewish property. Imagine how much property the Jews left in Spain. We're talking about a very, in many cases, very, very wealthy Jewish community. So from March 31st till the end of July, okay, going to be extended by a couple of days. Okay, at the end of that time, we have what is one of the worst disasters in Jewish history from the destruction of the Second Temple, which is the expulsion, which takes place on August 2nd of 1492. Okay, at which time, now the Jewish community of Spain numbered something like 300,000 Jews. Clearly, probably the largest Jewish community in the world at the time. Out of which, about half of them are going to leave, about 150,000. And another, we're not sure the exact number, most of the 150,000, by the way, is going to go to Portugal, where 5 years later, the king of Portugal is going to forcibly convert those and expel the rest. The remainder, many Jews, 50, 60,000 Jews are going to convert. Okay, and many Jews are going to die, by the way, drowned at sea, captured by pirates. The Jews who are going to leave Spain, they're going to go to places that are at odds with Spain. Like many of them go to Italy. Okay, many go to Amsterdam. Many are going to go to the New World, even eventually, which is going to come into existence. We're going to see very soon after Christopher Columbus. And 60,000 go to Turkey, by the way. The largest number of Jews leaving Spain goes to Turkey. I always get my pitch for Turkey now. Turkey, historically, is one of the countries that has been the nicest to the Jewish people in history. Very, very nice. Except for America, I think Turkey's the number one best friend of Jews in history. As a matter of fact, the Sultan of Turkey said at the time, they tell me that Ferdinand of Spain is a wise man, but he is a fool, for he takes his treasure and sends it all to me. What was he talking about? Right, 60,000 Jews. And look what happens. Spain, by the way, is going to peak in the next century in power. It's on its way up. It's going to peak and then go into tremendous decline. Okay, the rise and fall of Spain is very quick. Turkey, at exact period of time, is very interesting. If you look at the rise of the Ottoman Empire, with the decline of Spain is going to come the rise of Turkey as the greatest power in the world in the 16th century. Suleiman the Magnificent gets to Vienna, Austria, the biggest empire in the Western world at the time, no question. Okay, and what do you see? Remember the blessing that God gives to Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you? We see the rise and fall of empires corresponding. It doesn't happen overnight, but to the exodus and immigration of Jews into different places. Very, very interesting. But we have to appreciate what a tremendous disaster this is for the Jewish world. Okay? The most prosperous, settled community, been there for centuries, is thrown out. Christopher Columbus leaves the next day, August 3rd. Many people like to speculate Columbus was a Jew. My personal opinion is yes, he was. Okay? His first language, he's not Spanish, his first language was Castilian Spanish. Castilian Spanish is known to us as Ladino. That is the language that Spanish Jews spoke. In the 14th century, large numbers of Jews were expelled during the reconquest from Castile, and many of them go to Italy. Okay, that was Columbus's first language. He does these funky little marks when he writes. People like to think he's writing Bisiata de Shemaya, that famous little thing all Jews write. He always talks about Zion. There's a lot of interesting connections. There's a book called Christopher Columbus's Jewish Connection. If anyone wants to know more, and I'll give you the author. Not such an easy book to find, but very interesting. What's more interesting is Columbus's crew. Of the 120 people who leave on the Nina Pinta in Santa Maria, he has 5 known Jews, and the 6th, who is his translator, who is Luis de Torres, converted the day before. Remember, the day before, you have to convert or leave? He converts the day before. Luis de Torres was brought along because he spoke 12 languages, including Hebrew, and Columbus was sure he was not going to bump into America. That was found by accident. He was going to go to the Far East and find one of the 10 lost tribes there and need a Hebrew speaker. Luis de Torres, by the way, is the first person to settle on San Salvador, Columbus lands. The first person to settle America is Jewish. Very interesting in that period of time. His cook, the doctor, the navigator, also Jews. So 5 of the 120 crew. There's no question that Columbus's voyage to America is linked to the expulsion. And this is a great, fantastic, by the way, link in this whole idea of God makes the cure before the disease. Just as one of the greatest Jewish communities of medieval Europe is being destroyed, God is opening up the doors for what is going to be, albeit hundreds of years later, the greatest refuge for Jews in history, which is America. Okay, it's tremendous, tremendous pattern. By the way, Columbus's voyage was not financed by Ferdinand and Isabella selling her jewels. The major people pushing, and Columbus tried to sell to the King of Portugal before that, the major people pushing were all Jews, all Jewish court officials. A guy by the name of Luis de San Angel Gabriel Sanchez, who was the treasurer of Aragon, and a guy by the name of Jacob Caballero, who was the king's chamberlain. I'm talking about many Morano court officials were involved in putting up the initial money to finance Columbus's voyage. The first letter Columbus sends back from the New World is not to Ferdinand and Isabella, but to Sant'Angel and Sanchez, thanking them for the support and telling them what he found. Very, very interesting. Now the last, so we see the Jewish connection, Christopher Columbus. The last little person, not little, but very significant person I want to talk about is Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, the Abarbanel, who's one of the great Jewish personalities. Also this period of time, tremendous Torah scholar and rabbi, originally came from Portugal, hired by the Spanish government to be the treasurer of Spain, most powerful Jew in Spain. He advocated very strongly to try and rescind the expulsion order. Thomas de Torquemada advocated stronger. Is actually a great story when they're almost about to give in, allow the Jews to stay. The story is Thomas Torquemada, who is Isabel's confessor, walks in and throws the cross at the queen and hits her with it. And says, yeah, how dare you, you know, you're buying Judas. The Jewish community is offering a huge bribe. You're going to take the money of Judas and allow these, you know, killers of Christ to stay in the country, etc. And they give in and they throw the Jews out. So the person who actually leads the Jewish community into exile is going to be Don Yitzhak Abarbanel. Now, what day is the Jewish community sent into exile? August 3rd, August 2nd, 1492. What day is it in Jewish history? The 9th of Av. Okay? There you have, bam, bam, bam. First temple, second temple, Bar Kokhba, Beitar falling, destruction of the Jewish community of Spain, 4 biggest Jewish disasters in a row all falling out on that date. Okay, so we got to that unfortunate, bad end of the story. God, we're going to pick it up tomorrow with... really, the Jews of the modern world. We're into our last period of time in history, 15th century onward.